It's Saturday, the 23rd of April, 2016. This is me, Sami Shah, right here behind the microphone, and not behind the steering wheel, at home, actually. It's I think 8:30 p.m. at night, and hello, everybody. It's been a while. Hi, miss me? I missed you.
I did.
My voice is all right. So I've been gone a while. I've been gone, I think, 3 weeks off. I basically recorded my last episode maybe a week before the Melbourne Comedy Festival started. And then I couldn't do any episodes during the Melbourne Comedy Festival. The festival went on for 4 weeks, but or 3 weeks, I think, total. No, I think it was 4 weeks. Wow, has it been over 4 weeks since I did an episode? It's possible. But I was so caught up in working during that festival because I was doing the ABC thing where I was filling in for I was a fill-in host on Sunday Extra for the 4 weeks, and then I was also busy with my own show, and I just didn't want to. Initially, I tried recording an episode before during the early days of the festival, before my own show started, because my show was in the second 2 weeks of the festival. God, I've already bored myself and you. Look, I didn't do it earlier. I should have done it earlier, but I didn't because of a whole bunch of reasons that have everything to do with just I didn't want to bore you with the same kind of pre-festival nerves that I have every goddamn festival, and you've been through enough. And then during the festival, I was focused on that, and after the festival, I lost my voice, and it's only now kind of coming back. And it's still, I think you can still tell it's a little bit raw and it's a little lower. I'm talking a lower register than I'm used to. But yeah, that is what it is. All right, you don't need a long detailed explanation of where I've been for the last 4 weeks because it's not exciting. I mean, I'll tell you about the festival. We get into that. But let's get you caught up right now. It's a weekend. It's Anzac Day weekend. Which means Anzac Day is on Monday, which is when all of Australia commemorates the people who died. No, the Australian and New Zealand soldiers who died in the First World War and Second World War, and their deaths are commemorated by everyone baking an Anzac cookie, and which basically is a cookie that tastes like fallen soldiers. That's a joke I did on stage once in my first year in Australia in a pub because I thought it was funny, and the audience did not share my humor. I did that joke on Anzac Day. A bottle was thrown at me, and I'm gonna say rightly so. Maybe some areas you just don't go. But I decided to try going for that one. Just a long, long, well, just another moment in Sammy Shah's long line of or lengthy history of poorly judged moments. What's going on? Hey, you guys, let me catch your breath. How are you doing? So. Yeah, it's been a while. I've been away. I've been missing the podcast. I've been wanting to do it every day, and then something would happen or something else would happen. And I wouldn't, and I didn't get a chance. And now I finally have gotten this chance. Even now, I should be working, by the way. Like, I feel like I should be working, but I wasn't in the mood to work, and so I figured I'd just do this instead because my first opportunity in days and days and days and days and days, and my throat is healed enough for me to be able to do this. But it's a strange day. It's the yesterday Prince died, the musician, who I mean I didn't I always liked his music. I enjoyed his music. It wasn't as essential an essential part of my life as it has been for so many other people that I know. I felt the same with David Bowie or Bowie, I think David Bowie. I didn't know his music much. I think beyond just the one or two really famous songs and stuff, I really wasn't familiar with his discography. It's just one of those things which kind of slipped me by. I have these weird black holes in my pop cultural history, largely because I think a lot of the pop culture, the early pop culture that I consumed, was stuff that I, growing up in Pakistan, growing up where I did and the way I did, being the eldest sibling, so I didn't have an eldest sibling to kind of impart wisdom to me in terms of pop culture and stuff, or until Tahawa came along later in my life. I just kind of I saw what I saw. So, everything I experienced or saw was basically whatever the video store guy would give me. So, for example, I have very detailed memories of really trashy 1980s movies that no one else seems to have seen. But at the same time, I also missed a whole bunch of classics. So, like The Princess Bride. I never saw The Prince. I still have not seen The Princess Bride. And now I'm scared of seeing it because I'm not sure it'll hold up anymore and I'll just be disappointed. So I'd rather not see it at all than watch something that maybe doesn't stand the test of time. Maybe it does, who knows? But it's just something I have no curiosity for. David Bowie's the next. I just never encountered his music. It wasn't, and I think given my musical taste when I was young, I might not even have liked it if I hadn't encountered it. I think I was more of a, sadly, or unapologetically, if you will, I was a Phil Collins guy, like that was my stuff. I like Michael Jackson, I like Phil Collins, I like, so I think that might have been too weird for my delicate sensibilities. Prince, I liked because Taha Bhai, who was my elder cousin who died last year, he introduced me to Prince. He showed me the Purple Rain movie and he's like, oh, this is brilliant, this is genius, this guy's awesome, should watch it. And I remember not kind of getting it, but forcing myself to get it because I like Taha Bhai. I wanted to be like Taha Bhai, rather, because he was 2 years older than me. So he was my impromptu, well, not impromptu, inadvertent. That's the word I'm looking for, inadvertent elder brother. And then I kind of I remember there's a music video called for the song Gold. And there's a girl in that music video, and my best friend Taimur and I were obsessed with her. We were like, she's the most perfect girl in the world. She's utterly beautiful. She's absolutely fantastic. And I just found the video yesterday after hearing about Prince's death, and I watched it. And yeah, she's cute. I don't know why 13-year-old Sammy Shaw was so obsessed with her, but I was. But then today, Patton Oswalt's wife died. And that was a strange one, because Dave Anthony, the comedian, who I can now say is a friend, I think it's kind of cool to be able to say that. But yeah, we've hung out not, like twice, and we get along really well. And he posted a thing on Twitter saying, "I need to get off. I'll be offline for the next few days." And I was like, "Oh, I wonder what happened." And I did it, and just then it kind of popped up, and it was that comedian Patton Oswalt's wife, Michelle McNamara, is dead. And that kind of hit me worse than Prince, I think, because it was strange. But partly because I knew of Michelle McNamara separate from Patton Oswalt for years, because she set up the true crime website, that the one that has the best serial killer collections and articles on true crime and everything, is really well researched. And for a true crime junkie like me, it's always been a port of call for years, and I really enjoy it. So I kind of knew, I obviously I knew her from there, and that was my experience of her work. And then obviously I've always been obsessed with Patton Oswalt. At least I was when I was younger. I'm not sure I find his work appeals to me in the same way. It doesn't connect with me in the same way that it did when I first started doing comedy. But when I first started doing stand-up comedy, it kind of changed my voice and had a massive influence on me. And I could recite most of his albums entirely by heart because they just connected on that level with this kind of geek kid in Karachi trying to find his own voice in comedy. And there's this geek guy, kind of unabashedly embracing his geekdom, which is something I was always told not to do when I was defiantly trying. And I emailed Patton Oswalt when I was first starting out, through his website, and I said, "Hey, can you give me some advice on my comedy?" And he wrote back, which is kind of cool, and I actually detail that in my autobiography as well. And so yeah, it was just one of those little moments I had with him, which always kind of made me connect. But more importantly, he had his daughter was born about a month after mine was, and I thought that was like just it was a stupid coincidence, whatever. But it just kind of made me connect with him on, in my head at least on some level. And so that was upsetting to hear about his wife's death. They don't know, they haven't announced yet how she died. Apparently she died in her sleep. But knowing that there's, a 7-year-old girl now without a mother, that's upsetting to me. And how he'll have to deal with that now. That hurt me. And then I just realized a few hours ago, and I probably would have known this much earlier if I was in Karachi, but I'm not. I'm in Melbourne. And I realized a few hours ago that Sabine Mehmood died a year ago tomorrow. Tomorrow's her death anniversary. It's 1 year since Sabine was killed by basically a Islamic extremist because of his support for things like Valentine's Day and free speech in Karachi. And she was gunned down. And Sabine, you know, I've already discussed this. If you want to know, if you want to re-listen to, or if you haven't heard this before, if you want to listen to Sabine Mahmood and why she was probably one of the most important activists in Karachi during her lifetime, and what meant so much to me personally because I knew her on such a personal level, and we had a long history together, and how her death kind of really fucked me up for a while. You should listen to episode 21 of this podcast. It's on my website, www.samisha.com, SamishaH.com. If you go into the comedy tab, there should be podcasts link. Go there, I think on page 2 or page 3 of the podcast, the episode 21. I think it's called The Last Revolutionary or The Last Martyr or something. But that was me talking about Sabine. And if you listen closely, I think you can kind of hear the moments where I can't talk anymore because I'm trying not to cry. Yeah, that was a weird one. Just knowing that's been a year, it kind of hit me right now that it's been that long. Because I remember my sister messaged me in the morning, just tweeted me, and I woke up because my phone went ding, and I saw it was a message from my sister in Islamabad saying they got Sabine, and I knew right away what she was meant and what had happened, and just broke down. So yeah, that's. But that's that. Yes, it's been a weird few days, and it doesn't. It's none of this is helped, of course, by the fact that, and I'm going to make this about me because I'm selfish, but it is my podcast, and I'm a selfish, self-involved piece of shit. But I'm on that come down from the festival. There's a thing that happens once a festival finishes. All the performers who took part in that kind of, if you're not bouncing on to the next festival right away, where many of them are right now, they're in the Sydney Comedy Festival, then they go from there to the Perth Comedy Festival, or right now they're in Perth, then they go to Sydney, and then they come back from that, and then they go to Adelaide, and then they go to, then they come back from that and do the Melbourne Fringe. So they're bouncing for festivals, and so they maintain the high. But if you're like me, or many of the other people I know, you've had that come down period, and that come down period is strange. It hits you low, it drags you low, drags you down. So that's been a kind of not depressing. I don't want to say depressing, but slightly introspective last few days is what has resulted. But more importantly, I'll tell you about the festival, because this was my first Melbourne Comedy Festival. And let's get into that. Let's talk about my first Melbourne Comedy Festival. It was, okay, so in the lead up to the festival, I think the last time I spoke to you guys, I was panicking about ticket sales. And that panic got way worse, by the way. That panic did not abate at all. So what happened was I realized too late. All right, so here's let me reset. The festival starts. My show is in the last 2 weeks of the festival. So I have the first 2 weeks of the festival to kind of hang out and absorb things and go watch other people's shows and kind of, live through the festival. And it was exciting because this is my first Melbourne Comedy Festival. There were lots of shows I wanted to see, lots of people I wanted to see. And I had one or two people, friends of mine, like Jack McLeod and stuff, who could get me into the cool things. I'm too much of an unknown entity to be invited anywhere cool. So, Janet would take me to the festival launch party or whatever. It was the 30th anniversary of the Melbourne Comedy Festival. So there's lots of parties happening, and luckily I could sneak into some of them. So I went to, in the lead up to the festival, I'd been panicking about ticket sales, and that got way worse as the festival kicked off. Because I started seeing people posting, oh, sold out, my shows are sold out, oh, this and that, and I talked to every comedian, and it seemed like I had the lowest numbers out of anyone I knew, where I was at 14 pre-sales. So for a 2 week run of shows that was going to start in 2 weeks' time, I had sold 14 total tickets, and most of those were for the second week of shows. So I had sold 0 tickets for my first week of shows, which means I was going to have to cancel an entire week of shows. And that's a deeply, deeply depressing prospect for someone like me, or for most performers anyway. I think it's safe to say that much at least. And I was panicking, I was tail spinning. I used to go to the festival every day and I'd watch these amazing shows. I'd watch shows by artists and performers that I considered my peers for a very long time until I finally saw them doing their best things, their best shows, and having my mind blown completely by the craft and the creativity that they were bringing to the stage. And they're performing to these audiences, these packed numbers, and I'd look at that, and I'd look at my own ticket sales of 0000000007, 0002, 004, like that, and I'd be like, okay, so no, I'm new in Melbourne, and that's fine, but nobody's coming to see me. Like, this is it. This is all I get. No one knows who I am. No one's coming. I've been on, I guess I'll flyer, but that won't help much because my venue is the Malthouse Theatre, which is far from the festival hub. And so if I fly, if I tried flyering people, I'd be like, here's a flyer for my show. It starts in 2 weeks. Oh, and it's a 14-minute walk that way. And I'd always be told, yeah, thanks. No. So I didn't even bother doing that anymore. And I'd wasted $500 on flyers and on posters. And I was just kind of hurting. And I was also upset about the fact that my own show was so boring to me. Because, like I said, it was going to be a best of, right? It was just going to be that first, same iMigrant show that I did my first year in Melbourne, in Australia at the Perth Comedy Festival, which won the award at Perth Comedy Festival, which the Soho Theatre then took. And I took that to the Soho Theatre. And by the time it reached the Soho Theatre, by the way, which is last year, I had already tossed it out a year before and I had to dust it off for the Soho. And then once I was done with the Soho Theatre, I was like, I never have to do this material again. I'm tired of telling the same goddamn story and I'm done. And then again, everyone was like, no, do that show, do that show. It's the award-winning show, do that show. And I was like, all right, fine. And then I just didn't want to. Just the idea of it was boring to me. And so that in those first 2 weeks, I was going and watching all these other shows and being inspired. And then I went and saw comedian Laura Davis, who's a very good friend of mine, who Laura is one of those first people who gave me. Laura gave me my first headline spot in Australia. She used to run at the time in Perth. She used to run Lazy Susan's, which was my favorite comedy room in the world, and basically home to me. The Lazy Susan stage is where I'm most at home, and. So, and Laura used to run that when I was in Perth and when I was in Northam, and I used to go down and I did the open mic rooms for a few months. And she kind of saw me doing that, and then she asked me to do one or two support spots, and I did those. And then one day she just called me up and said, hey, you want a headline? And I said, yeah. And after that, Laura booked me regularly as a headliner. And yeah, so like, and I've performed with Laura many, many times. I've seen her perform many, many times, but always in a comedy club setting. Never in the thing that is Laura's element, where she's at her best, which is, in a festival. So I went to watch a show, and this is 2 days before my show starts. I am still at 14 pre-sales for a 2 week run of shows, and my shows start 2 days away. And I've seen a whole bunch of shows. I've been getting inspired and blown away by all of them, like No Show by Ben Russell and Xavier Michaelides, and Greg Fleet's show, based on his book, and Jonestown, which is a sketch comedy troupe here, which is phenomenal. And yeah, and Chimp Cop, and all these other shows. And I sat down at Laura's show because I was like, oh, this might be my only opportunity to watch it because it runs at the same time as my show. And I had to buy a ticket to get in because I couldn't even get in otherwise. It was sold out every night. And I sat down, and Laura Davis did something that was so honest and so beautifully crafted and pure comedy, but also pure personality and pure humanity, which sounds like a really wanky way of describing it. But I don't want to describe it because I will ruin the novelty of the show by describing it to people. She's, look, if you're in Perth or if you're in Melbourne and you haven't seen the show, if you're in Melbourne, she's definitely going to do it at the Melbourne Fringe this year. If you're in Perth, she's definitely going to do the Perth Comedy at the Perth Fringe Festival next year. You have to watch it. You have to watch it. You don't understand how beautifully constructed that show is. And I had this thing where I was watching that show, and I'd also gotten to the point now where that, those sleepless cycles kind of happen where insomnia kicks in for me. and I hadn't slept in 2 nights. I was kind of wired from that, and I've been working long hours at the ABC, and I was kind of trying to wrap up my documentary that I'm still working on these days, and all of that kind of piled up, and I was more emotionally raw when I watched Laura's show, and I kind of connected with all the right places in me, and I ended up walking out of that show and having that kind of moment, which happens to me sometimes, which sounds really wanky again when I describe it, but it's true. Where I think the only way to describe it for me is a fugue state, where I'm not aware of what I'm doing, where I am, what's happening, and I just have an idea and I need to write it down. And so I sat down on a bench outside a 7-Eleven, and I threw out half my show, and I rewrote it. And I centered it around basically me trying to kill myself last year, which is a story I haven't actually told you guys, and I feel bad about that because I now have told, hundreds of strangers. But yeah, last year I when I was saying goodbye to Perth and saying goodbye to Northam, and in the last few days, in those last few weeks, actually, between the Rotto Fest, Rotten Asylum Festival, and or not even Rotto Fest, was it between Rotto Fest? I don't remember. I just remember there were a few weeks left before I was supposed to pack up and move to Melbourne, and I had a farewell party where all the comedians in Perth threw me a fantastic party. It was a great moment, and I was driving back at night to Northam, and I started thinking about the things I was giving up again, all my friends I was going to give up again. Like, I gave them up once in Pakistan, and I gave them up again now to move to Melbourne and starting again, and being tired of being alone and feeling lonely, and just trying again from scratch to build up a life once more, and being knocked down the ladder once again, and all those things. And I had a moment where I was driving, and I considered closing my eyes and taking my hands off the steering wheel and seeing what happens. And I closed my eyes, and I was going to take my hands off the steering wheel. It's weird. I told the story on stage for 2 weeks, and that was fine. But telling it now is weirder. But yeah, I took my hands off the steering wheel and I closed my eyes, and the car was going at night on the highway. And I knew I wouldn't hit anyone else because at that stretch of the highway, there's no one else for miles. I figured at most it'll go off the side or hit a tree or something. And then I thought of a bit. That's what happened. I thought of a bit. I thought of a stand-up bit, and I opened my eyes. And I don't know. I have theories on. I think basically my brain kind of said, "No, we're not going to die. This fucking idiot. He's so selfish. The only thing that'll stop him from killing himself is a stand-up bit," and that's what happened. And I've never had that before. I've never been that depressed before. I've never had those thoughts before. At most I've been mildly melancholy. But last year was a weird year. Last year was the first year where I really, I think, struggled with depression, or was in a depressive state, something that I've never had to deal with before in my life. And I think it had a lot to do with Taha Bhai and Sabine and just Northam and that drive every damn day, 2 hours down, 2 hours back, through the hills, alone by myself, and just that loneliness kind of eating away at me. And yeah. And I decided I hadn't told that story to anyone, and I figured it was time. So I rewrote my show and structured it around that story, because I just had this thing where I was like, look, I'm gonna do a show that I don't like to an audience that isn't there. Why am I bothering? Why am I even doing the festival? At least do something that means something to me. And I could have, look, if I had done the iMigrant show the way it was intended, I probably would have gotten a nomination or something. Because it was a solid hour of, award-winning stand-up, which is what it was. I mean, everyone who's ever seen that show says, oh, it's riotous, wall-to-wall funny, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the show I want to do anymore. I was getting tired of, I'm at the phase now where I'm getting tired of the setup punchline format, that kind of ba-dum-ba-dum-tush beat and rhythm to a joke, where you do the setup, you do the punchline, you do the callback, and the predictability of that, where I can hear the punchline coming a mile away when I write it, and I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do something different. And I watch Laura's work and I watch other people's work, and I was like, everyone is putting themselves out there. Why am I being such a coward? What am I risking? And so that's what I did. I rewrote the show and I figured, hey, no one's going to see it anyway, but at least it's something I will be excited about doing when and if I finally get to do it, because, as it currently stands, I might have to cancel shows. And then I went on Facebook in the meantime. The day, I think the day off my, yes, I rewrote the show entirely on a bench outside a 7-Eleven, with a ballpoint pen in a moleskin that I bought. Or just not even a moleskin, I think just a regular notebook that I bought from the 7-Eleven. And then I went home, and then the next day I was at the ABC, and I didn't think about it. And then the day of my show, my first night, I went on Facebook, and the ticket sales were still nothing. I think I had zero for that night, or I had one for that night. And I went on Facebook, and I put it in a group where all the comedians and everyone hang out and doing every fringe. And doing the festivals, and I said, "Look, if anyone wants to come, I'd really appreciate any bums on seats, because no, I'm going to be performing to an empty room, and just if it'd be cool if people were there, and mean a lot to me." And people are fucking awesome. Comedians are great, and artists and performers, and it's a community of people that I'm really, really, really honored to be kind of. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but it's true. I keep saying it. I can't believe this is my tribe. It took me years in Pakistan to like, of feeling like an outsider, to finally come to Australia and find my tribe over here. And that tribe is comedians and performers, and these are my people. And it was great to finally and have them all say, "Yeah, we'll be there." And a bunch of them, went above and beyond and started promoting my show to their friends and families and stuff, and asking them to come. Angela, Claire, who does a lot of shows here, Sarah Jones, who does a lot of shows here, and all these cool people, they all kind of, put the word out, which is awesome. So I get to the venue on the night. It's a beautiful venue. The Malt House Theatre is an astoundingly beautiful venue. And I was looking at it and I was like, okay, I'm not doing justice to this venue, because I'm just going to be doing. We were doing a show I've never done before now, at least half the show. The first half is still I, Migrant. But the second half is entirely new thing. And I'm going to be doing that on stage in this beautiful, it's a proper theater space. It's a beautiful theater space with massive auditoriums and theater rooms. And I had a really, really lovely room with a nice stage. All the other people I know were performing in back rooms and conference rooms of hotels and basements of motels and stuff. And I had this beautiful venue with beautiful seating, beautiful lighting, great sound, acoustics, all of that. A proper green room in which I could go in. And I sat down in that green room and I was like, I guess I'm doing this. And for the first time in a long time, I vomited before the show. I vomited because I thought I'd go out on stage and there'd be two, maybe three people there. I vomited because I was going to do something that was more honest than anything I'd ever done before. And I vomited because I just did. And then the way it's set up is that the room in which I'm performing, there's a curtain. The stage is on one side and the audience is on that side and everything. And there's a big, thick black curtain, and you stand on the other side of that. And there's a microphone there with which you announce yourself onto the stage. So I can't see the audience. I don't know how many people are there. It's pretty quiet. I'm expecting two, maybe three people, maybe, out of which two of them will probably be friends. And I take the microphone and I say, "Please give it up for Sammy Shah." I don't even think I put any oomph behind the announcement. I think I just kind of said, "Give it up for Sammy Shah," whatever. And I heard a lot more than two people. I was like, "That's confusing." And I go around, and there's in a 75-seater, there's 58 people there. I check the numbers later. There's 58 people there. I don't know who the fuck they are. I don't know where they came from. I don't know what they're doing there, but they're there. And they're all applauding, and I get up on stage, and now I'm panicking because I had a solid hour of stand-up comedy that I could be presenting, that I should be presenting to a room full of packed room full of people. Instead, I now have an experimental show that I've only half done before, and the other half is entirely new. And it's a personal story, and it requires me to talk at a different pace than I normally talk. I talk slowly, I build up tension, I drop tension, I do all these things that I've never done before that I only have in my head. I've just got a set list vaguely written in my head, and that's it. And these people there. And so, yeah, I went up and I decided, I'm like, fuck it, because here's what happens. When I decided I wasn't going to do that old show anymore, I threw it out of my head. I tossed it out. I couldn't even pull it up if I wanted to at that point. So I took the microphone and just did the new show. And I think it went all right. I think it went okay that first night. There were definitely some hiccups in the structure of it. On the second night, I kind of got it better. And I thought... So I made my sacrifice to Thalia. And so that's what was happening. So you know my Thalia theory, right? Thalia is the eighth muse. Really quick recap. She's the eighth muse. She's the muse of comedy, Greek muses. And she's the muse of comedy and poetry. And she, I believe, requires a sacrifice. And this has gone from a bit of a lark that I just talk about to something I can kind of fervently believe in now almost, where Thalia requires a sacrifice. And usually the way you do that, you sacrifice a show to her. And what happened was, in the lead up to the festival, I did, so there was, on the first day of the festival, I didn't have a show, right? My show starts 2 weeks later. 2 weeks into the whole festival is when my show has its first night. So the day before that, the day before the launch of the festival, I'm getting the timelines so confused right now. The day before the launch of the festival, Ivana Ristigetta and I are out in town in Brunswick, and we're getting just progressively drunker as we're talking about our miserable lives and our careers. And we're happy with our careers. Both of us are in very good places. Ivana's obviously in a fantastic place. I'm also pretty content with it. But, you know, personal lives are shambles. And we're both talking about that and getting progressively drunker as we are. And we bump into this guy named Micah, who I've never met before. And he tells me that he runs a room during the festival, and he's had someone drop out and he's got the room empty for one night. And would I like to do a preview show? And I said, you know what? I don't want to do a preview show. Instead, what I'll do is I'll do an hour of new material, the stuff that I've been doing for the last few months that needs honing. And that way, if anyone's bought tickets to my regular festival show, they can also come down and watch that and watch my festival show, and they get two different shows. And so I told that to my... And so we did that. And I figured, here's what I was trying to do. I figured that would be my sacrifice to Thalia. I was like, nobody's going to come to this. It's going to be totally empty. I literally have 24 hours to promote it on Facebook and Twitter. And it's going to be an empty room. And I'm going to do an hour of material to an empty room that isn't in the mood to listen to me. And a lot of this material is stuff I'm still honing in open mics and stuff. It's going to be terrible for everyone. And it'll be my sacrifice to Thalia, because it'll go so badly. She will be sated and satisfied. Except it went well. Somehow, just people passing by or whatever decided to give it a shot. Word got out. I don't know what happened, but there were around 20 to 30 people there. And I got up and I did that new material, and it went all right. It went pretty good. Wasn't destroying, but it went all right. Not enough to satiate Thalia's hunger. And so, Sheely, you know, that show ends. And now I figure, all right, Thalia is going to tank me on that first night, because I figured there'd be two people in the audience and it's going to go terribly with a new show that I haven't done. And then I get up and there's 58 people in the audience and it goes well. I'm like, all right, second night. Thalia is now really fucking hungry. Second night goes well as well. And there's only second night, by the way, there's massive drop down. I think there was like 19 people or something. But again, it went well. And I'm like, I guess I'm just being superstitious. This is stupid of me, whatever. And maybe confirmation bias was at play, or maybe it's just Thursdays are shit days. But on that third day, which was a Thursday, I walk out on stage and there's around 19 people in the audience. And of those 19 people, I know, because I've heard reliably from people, that there's most of the festival judges are in the audience to watch me and to decide whether or not I qualify for the best newcomer, which is what the word on the street apparently was that I would be nominated for. And that's the night that Thalia pulled out her knife and fork. I get up on stage and I start doing the show and I get nothing. And you know in the first 30 seconds what kind of crowd it is. Every comedian worth his chops or her chops with any experience under the belt knows how to read a crowd within the first 30 seconds. And in the first 30 seconds, I'm like, oh, fuck. It's that kind. It's the kind that I got on my third night at the Soho Theater. Which I remember distinctly on my third night at the Soho Theater, I did this reliable show that's won awards and that gets laughs every time, and the crowd was silent the entire time. And you never know why. This is where my Thalia theory came from. It developed because of this one night that happens to every comedian, where we all have these runs where you're doing a great run of shows and suddenly in one night there's silence and you never know why and you can't figure out what the cause is because the audiences are sourced from the same places, the material exactly the same, everything's the same, yet it goes badly. And that's started happening. And so in the first 30 seconds, I'm like, all right, I guess this is what it is. That's the kind of night it is. And then halfway through the show, I made a massive error in judgment. And I think it was conscious. I'll tell you what I did first, and then I'll tell you why I think I did it. Here's what I did. I, like a jackass, decided this isn't working. Let's stop the show for a little bit and do some crowd work to kind of get them going, get them lively. Crowd work is a reliable tool to kind of get the audience more engaged. In a regular comedy club, that's what you use. So I halfway through the show, I take a break from my material and I do a little bit of crowd work. And it works. The crowd is there. I'm like, look, you know, I know this stuff works. I know it's not, right now, it's not me, it's you. Come on, get with me. And then do something like, what's your name, sir? This and that, ha ha, whatever. Why aren't you laughing at me? Why are you judging me? And I make him laugh and then he laughs. And then because he laughs, everyone else around him laughs. And then I do that to 2-3 other people. I get the room. I do it on the left, I do it on the right, and I do it at the back. And that way now the entire room is working. I start the material again, and the moment I start the material, they shut down. They shut down again. They're not giving me anything, and they're quiet, and they're silent. And now here's what happened. I was doing material about race. Now, the first two nights, that material worked. But also because the first two nights, I had toned it down because I didn't know what I wanted to say about race until the third night is when I started figuring out, okay, I'm going to talk about these issues. And what I realized was happening, and I realized this too late, it took me another day or two to kind of figure this out, is that audiences in Melbourne have a very different reaction to racial topics than audiences anywhere else in Australia. If you're performing in Western Australia and you tell people in the audience in WA that you are racist, they say, yes, we are, and then they engage with it because everyone in Australia tells them they're racist. They largely know they're racist and they engage with the racism. They might not apologize for the racism and they definitely probably will not change being racist. Maybe I shouldn't start the word definitely and follow it up with the word probably. But anyway, that's how I structure my sentences. And they're not going to change their racism, but they do acknowledge that, yes, we are racist. You know, it's one of those like, yeah, what you gonna do kind of things. But now, when you get someone to acknowledge that they are racist and then talk about their racism, the acknowledgement helps them engage with the material and they laugh. In Melbourne, they think they're better than the rest of Australia. The rest of Australia is racist. How can we be? We're better than them. We aren't racist. And what that does is it makes them think that, stop telling us about racism. Why are you wasting your time telling us this? We aren't racist. It's not our problem. And they get defensive. And when they get defensive, they get angry. And that's what was happening, is they would shut down. Now, in the later nights, once I figured that out, I knew how to deal with it. Because what I used to do then was I would do the racism material, I'd get the silence, and then I'd go, here's the thing. you guys are all quiet right now, and I know why you're quiet is because you don't think that you don't think you're racist. You think you're better than WA. Here's why I respect WA is because there's integrity to their racism. They have integrity to their racism. You know, people in Melbourne don't. But the secret that no one tells you all is that you're all just as racist. You can add the Asylum Seeker Resource Center on your Facebook page. It doesn't fucking matter. You're just as racist as anyone else is, and I'll tell you why. And then I used to give them examples based on their behavior during the course of the night that prove their racism, and then I'd point out my own racism, making it okay for people to cop to their racism, and that's how I'd get them to laugh. I worked it into a bit. But on that third night, I didn't have those things in place. I didn't have those judgments in place. I didn't have the tools in place. I didn't have the knowledge in place. And I had made a bad decision. I did the crowd work. I did the material. Material, they shut down again. And I was talking about racism, and they shut down at that point. And then I snapped. And I stopped the material, and I said, what the fuck is the problem? Because I'm not going to do this show if you guys keep acting like this. And I turned to a woman in the front, and I said, why won't you laugh? And she said, stop calling us racist. And I fucking flatlined. I went, pee! I went Bruce Banner Hulk. It turned ugly. I basically started yelling. I did. I told her she was racist. I told the audience they were racist. At one point during my ranting, I might have even said something along the lines of, look, I've been told that there are festival judges here tonight. I don't give a, and I probably shouldn't be doing this. I don't give a fuck. I've gotten where I've gotten in life without winning any awards. All the awards I've gotten have not made any difference to my ticket sales. The only thing that matters to me and my ticket sales and the audiences is whether or not I'm funny. And right now, you're not letting me be funny, so go fuck yourselves. And if there's any reviewers here tonight, I don't give a shit about that either, because you know who reads your reviews? The editor and me. And that's it. There's no audience member who's ever read a review. I could quote your entire review on my poster and no one would give a shit as long as I put laurel wreaths around them in the illustration. And I said that. I basically harassed half the crowd enough that they walked. They basically got up and walked out. And as they were walking out, I told them, don't you dare go watch anyone else's show, because this festival deserves better than you can offer as an audience. Go home. Nobody wants you. And then I turned to the remaining audience and I said, here's what's going to happen. I had a really good show. There's an honest show and a meaningful show and a show that I'm proud of. And I'm not going to waste it on you guys. Instead, I'm going to tell you three shitty old stories of mine that are hacky and not particularly funny. And I only keep them for the worst crowds. And now you're going to get them. And you're so crap, you're probably going to laugh. And I told them the first story and they laughed. And I yelled at them for doing that. I told them the second story and they laughed again. And I yelled at them for doing that. I told them the third story and they didn't laugh. And then I really yelled at them. And then I told them, have a good night. Just go home. Nobody wants you. Go home. And I went back into my room, into the green room. And there are festival judges there. And I think there's a reviewer from the Sydney Morning Herald there. And I did not get a review in the Sydney Morning Herald. And I did not get nominated for anything at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And here's why I think I did that. Two things. The first is, I can deal with a bad show when it's heckling. I can deal with those things. I've been heckled. I've been attacked by a new... I've been attacked by the a racist bartender in Southern Cross. I've been heckled by a neo-Nazi in Mandurah. I can handle that. I know how to work with that. I can't handle the silence. Nothing hurts more when you're on stage as a comedian than indifferent silence. And the last time I had this kind of indifferent silence was at the Soho Theatre. And the moment this started, I started flashing back to the Soho Theatre. And in that Soho, here's the thing. I had it once as well during the Perth Fringe Festival. And what I did that time was I stopped the show and I did crowd work and I got them back because I decided I'm never going to just power through the show for an hour of silence. I'm better than that. As a comedian, I'm more experienced as a comedian. I'm going to get them back on my side. And the Perth Fringe Festival, I did it and it worked. So I thought, hey, you know what you're doing. Do it again here. And I tried it here. It didn't work. And that was the first thing that happened, where I thought I had the skills to make it work, but I don't. Or maybe I do, and sometimes Seinfeld is wrong. Jerry Seinfeld said that it's never the audience's fault. And maybe sometimes it is, Jerry. Maybe sometimes it is. But the other thing that happened is, since I've told people I'm coming to Melbourne, every comedian I know has been wonderful and lovely when they say this. But the consequences of them saying it are unintentional. They would always say, oh, you're shoo-in for next year's Best Newcomer Award. You're definitely going to win the Best Newcomer Award. You got the Best Newcomer Award. And I always say, no, so being silly, I'm not a newcomer. I've been doing this for 10 years now. How can I get a newcomer award? Like, no, you'll win an award. When I came here, all the people who support my comedy and kind of got me into the Malthouse Theatre and all these things, everyone I know would be like, oh, you're definitely going to win an award. Someone of your caliber doing comedy for the first time in Melbourne Comedy Festival, the judges are going to love you. You're going to win an award. 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 Award, 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 award. At the Perth Fringe Festival, which is the only other festival, I've only done Perth Comedy Festival once. The first time I did it, which is the first only time I did it, in 2013, and I won the award there. And you know what? It made no difference. The next night, when Lazy Susans put my name on the poster, the same amount of people came that used to come before. And they came for the room. They didn't come for me. And the Perth Fringe Festival never, ever nominated me for anything, even though I did some of my funniest shows there. And then the show that they nominated and then they gave the award to was Islamofarcist, which they gave it for the best comedy, but it's not a very funny show. So I kind of sort of think that the awards are bullshit anyway. But what happens is that they carry a certain weight with them where you don't give a shit if you're nominated or not until you get nominated. And you don't give a shit that you're going to win or not until you think, maybe I might win. And I started thinking, I'm pretty sure what happened was, if I tank this, if I burn this to the ground, then they won't give me an award. Not because my show isn't funny, but because it was just a bad night. And that's a better excuse that I can live with that. I would have a tougher time living with the thing of the judges came, they saw me do my best. They saw me be creative and original and everything that I try to be and decided, it's not very good. And they choose not to. And all those expectations of all those people, I don't live up to that. And I also disappoint my own hype and all those things. And so I figured, you know what? I think a part of my brain said, just self-sabotage is the best way to go. And I think I basically set that room on fire that night, proverbially, to not have to face the weight of expectations. And that was a damn shame. I really think I fucked myself over there. And I went back that night and I put it up on Facebook that this is what happened. I walked the room full of judges and I was so angry. And a bunch of comedians kept coming up to me after that. The next day, by the way, my show was fine. Every night after that, my show has been fine. I've had a great night every night. For the entire run, I had a great night. But there was that thing where every comedian would come up to me and they'd be like, oh my God, I heard what you did. The word kind of got around and people started talking about it. And they're like, oh, I heard what you did, dude. I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to walk a room during the festival. You don't give a fuck. That's great. Until Nick Cody, who's a comedian I've maybe gigged with twice in Perth when he used to come through there sometimes. And he's a great comedian. He's a very good comedian. He's a great comedian, in fact, and inventive and original and just really cool. And someone I have a great deal of respect and time for. And he came up to me and he said, look, man, I've heard what happened. Everyone's been talking about it. And you're a good comedian. Everyone here respects you. You're a good comedian and you know what you're doing. Why would you do that? Why would you be so unprofessional as to have a tantrum on stage? You're not, this is the festival, this is what we work all year for, and you tanked it. For what? Because the crowd was shitty? You've got to be more mature than that. And he was right. And I knew he was right, and this ginger Buddha who kind of walked out of the mists of Halil Sisters, which is a pub that everyone hangs out at after the festival, and he kind of walked up to me and he gave me this wisdom, and he called me on my bullshit, and he was right, and that helped. It helped a lot. I went back in and the next day, and I just kept doing my show, and I kept getting it better, getting it tighter. And some nights were great, some nights weren't great. Some nights the crowds were good, some nights the crowds weren't that good, and it didn't matter. I did my hour. I actually ended up taking it up to an hour and 20 minutes every night is how long the show became. And it was honest and it was true, and it wasn't a pure comedy show. It was more of a story, and I enjoyed doing it. I still never want to do this one again either. I think I'm done with telling my story as a comedy premise. I'd rather just do comedy bits, but, you know, that happened. One other thing happened, by the way, which is worth retelling as well, which is, I think a few days after this incident, I was backstage in the green room. What would happen is every morning, so I'd get up at 6 a.m., I'd get Anya ready for school, I'd drop her to school, and then I would go to the ABC, where I would then work from 9 to 5, basically, on getting things ready for the Sunday Extra show that I was the guest host on. And then I would, at 5 o'clock, that would finish, and I'd rush across to the Malthouse Theatre, and I would shower and change in the green room there, and then I'd get up and do my show. And I wouldn't eat much all day because of this, and I wouldn't get a chance to eat, and I was famished every single day. I'd usually end up eating after the show. So one day I was there, and there was a food truck outside the venue, and they were making French fries, and if you know anything about me, you know that despite all my foodie sensibilities and my absolutely love and adoration for inventive and creative foods, nothing is my weak spot more than just French fries. Just French fries. I'm a fucking fool for French fries. And I smell them, and I think I need to have these in my belly right now. So I bought a small box of those. Went upstairs to my green room. Sitting alone in my green room an hour before my show starts, there's no one else in the theater, in my theater space. It's just me in this green room all by myself and silent, quiet, contemplating my show, eating some chips, and pop a chip in my throat and without chewing it properly, swallow it. It goes down the pipe wrong and lodges in my throat, and I'm choking. And I'm choking properly, where I'm gagging, I can't breathe, I try coughing it up, it doesn't come up, it just seems to get stuck worse. I start trying to call out for help, but I can't do that, I can't get a voice out. I start getting up to run to the thing, and I can't, because once the panic hits, I start flailing, I start thinking I'm going to start blacking out any second, and because I think I'm going to black out any second, my vision started blurring, and I thought, this is how I die. I am dying backstage an hour before my show with a chip lodged in my throat, and that's how they're going to fucking find me? This is how I die. And then I thought of the Heimlich maneuver. I didn't know if you can apply it to yourself, but I decided to try. So I basically jammed my own thumb into my solar plexus, which is the place just below your ribcage, which I remember from doing karate as a child more than any Heimlichs I've ever. I've never learned how to do the Heimlich, but I do remember when we did karate as a child, if you got hit over there properly, you vomited. Like, it hurt like a motherfucker. And I just punched myself 3 times in my solar plexus until a chip came flying out. And I didn't die. And I got up on stage, and my voice was, and since then my voice has been raspy and getting worse every single day. But I got up on stage an hour after that, and I was like, I just died, you guys. And they're like, yeah, whatever, dude, tell us your story. But yeah, that was a weird one. Definitely frightening. But yeah, I finished my run of shows, and it was cool. I got to hang out with great people. I went every night to the festival bar, and I met lots of great comedians. And I used to have to go home early, which sucked because I had the ABC thing in the morning. But I think that's also okay, because I'm not, I like parties. I like going to parties and I like dancing at parties, but I only like them when we're like in Perth, when I had a group with me, right? I had my group of friends. So every time I'd go to a party, I'd meet everyone. They'd all be happy to see me. I'd be happy to see them. I had people to hang out with. In Melbourne, I don't have that. I don't have my group yet. I don't know if I ever will because it seems like it's a very non-groupy kind of city where the groups formed a while ago and they kind of stay together. And so what would end up happening is I'd go to the bar. I go to the Hairy Little Sisters, which is the bar where everyone hangs out, and that's fun because you get to talk to people. And then everyone goes to the festival club where there's music and a DJ and everyone's dancing. And I would go there and I try dancing. But I can dance alone. But it's one thing if you're dancing alone at no lights, no lycra, where it's dark, that's fine. If you're dancing alone on a crowded dance floor, then you're the weird guy. And that I was very self-conscious of that, and I couldn't really talk to anyone because the music's too loud. And I can't really hang out with anyone because I'm not part of any groups, and so I'd end up feeling just lonely and sad, and so I'd leave instead. And I think that's a weird thing. I met a writer recently, a very good friend of mine from Perth. Well, not a very good friend of mine. We always met at writers' festivals. This Perth writer, who I won't name because this is what I'm going to reveal is very personal, but. She and I would meet at every writers' festival and always get along. We're always like, let's make we need to hang out. We clearly get along. We need to hang out. There's obviously two people who can be very good friends, and we never got the time to. And so she was in Melbourne for a few days, and she's like, look, I'm in town. Let's finally hang out. And I was like, that's great. And we do that, and we met up. And she just finished a long tour. I mean, I was talking, and I was like, how's the tour? And she's like, oh, it was amazing. I got to see all these cool countries and travel these amazing places. And her book is a bestseller around the world. And all these things, and I was like, that's great. How were you through the tour? And that's when she was like, yeah, no one's ever asked me that. I was fucking lonely. And that's the thing, is all of us, it's a thing that you can't complain about because people who aren't in the creative arts think, oh, boo-hoo, whatever, you look at you living your dream, oh, you're a little sad, whatever. You can't complain about that to them, but it is a very genuine thing. We do a lot of our shows and we do our shows. We go back to our hotel rooms and I travel for gigs and I go back to my motel or my hotel or I'm driving in the cars and after shows. And there's so much loneliness involved. She had the same thing. She'd go night after night. She'd do the questions at the different writers' events that she attended and she'd answer this. They'd ask the same questions. She'd give the same stock answers. And it was boring. It was tiring. But you do it because it's your job. And then you'd go back to your hotel room. And it's nighttime, and you sit there watching TV, and you're staring in the middle distance, and you're eating, bar food, the food from the mini bar, and that's every night. And I do that all the time as well. And yeah, I'm going to Tassie next week. I'm going to Tasmania for 2 days for gigs, and then I come back. And then like I'm going to Melbourne. I'm going to Perth later this year, later this month. In May, I'm going to Perth for a corporate gig. It would have just been a fly in, do a corporate gig, stay in a hotel for the night, and that thing. And I told them, I was like, actually, can you book me in for 4 or 5 days? Because I want to go back there. I want to spend 4 or 5 days just hanging out with my Perth friends again. Just people like Sean Choice and Ben Sutton and everyone, and getting food with them and just being a part of a gang for a little while. Just so I can feel, that, which is a thing. But I also think now. That loneliness, now I'll get into this in the next episode, maybe at some point, but I think loneliness is the most universally shared human experience in the 21st century. Everyone I know is lonely. People in relationships are lonely. People in other relationships are lonely. It's just what it is. I think there is that. I think at some point, some artist or writer or creative person is going to create a work of art around loneliness, the theme of loneliness, and it'll be one of the most defining works of our time. I don't think it's happened yet, though. I don't know who's going to do it. But yeah, it's I think that. So that way I got lucky in that doing the ABC thing required me to go to Hairy Little Sisters, hang out with everyone, have some cool conversations with people, and then leave early because I had to get up at 6 a.m. every day. So I'd get home by midnight, go to sleep, wake up at 6 a.m., start again, rinse, repeat for 4 weeks. And that kind of made things a lot better, I think. Got me to avoid some of the more gnarly parts of introspection. if you will. But yeah, I didn't get nominated for anything. I didn't win anything. That's fine. It's my first Melbourne Fringe Comedy Festival. Again, I'm glad I didn't because I don't want to worry about those things. I hate nominations and all that. And I know clearly that it's not going to happen for me. And that takes the pressure off it. So next year I can have more fun with it. I can do something else, at next year's thing. Right now, Melbourne Fringe Festival is coming up in September, I think. I'm probably going to do a 2 week run of Islamo-Farcist over here. I would really like to go to London in August for a week or two if I can. Do something with the BBC there, maybe the Soho Theatre. Who knows? Let's see what happens. In the meantime, I'm Sammy Shah. You can always find me at www.samishar.com, SamiShah.com, Facebook.com/samishar.fans, Twitter.com/samishar @samishar, and samishar@gmail.com is where you can email me or contact me. Send me a feedback, send me a spare change. Tell me what you think and what you feel and how you are. I always like hearing from you guys. Sorry for the long hiatus. I am back. Let's get this back on a weekly schedule and commit to it and do this. Too many breaks this year. I don't like that. I'm not going to do that again this year. This year, I'm going to commit to a schedule from now on. I'm Sammy Shah. You've been listening to Sammy Says.